Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. This is Dr. John Stamey, and you are listening to ScaryCast, the most enjoyable 90 minutes of hoodoo, fun, paranormal, and everything else. We're glad to have everybody here. Apparently, we have a crowd tonight, and that's great because we've got a really cool guest on. He is from the area of New Hanover Tavern, north of Richmond in Virginia, and he recently ran the New Hanover Paracon, which I missed because of all the weather, and so he's back, and he's up to his old tricks. He's got a lot of stuff going on, and ladies and gentlemen, let's introduce Steve Dills. How are you doing tonight, Steve?
I am good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. So tell us, how did the Paracon go? What all went down? And also, if I'm not mistaken, you have a couple of new events coming up the rest of this year. And so would you please let us know tonight what those are?
Sure. Yeah, we have a boatload of things going on. The Paracon went awesome, man. Just a little backstory. Myself and my team, Transcend Paranormal, have been working with the Hanover Tavern for a long time, probably close to, well, over a decade at this point. And for those that don't know, Hanover Tavern is situated in Hanover County, Virginia. It is just north of Richmond, and it is one of the oldest surviving and operating colonial taverns in America. So the original tavern that stood there on the ground was built sometime between the 1730s and 1750s. And then over time, you know, that tavern got old and dilapidated, and so they decided that, hey, it's time to build a new tavern. So what we call the quote-unquote new tavern, or the current tavern, actually dates back at the earliest to 1791, and then an addition to it was built on in 1821, and then the final piece that connected these two buildings together in 1830s. So, this tavern has stood for quite some time.
Steve, I'm going to interrupt you because we've got a buddy of mine, one of our great co-hosts, the Surgeon General of ScaryCast. Dr. Trey Donaway is with us. How are you doing tonight, Trey?
Good, John. Sorry, I'm signing on a few minutes late. I just got home.
That's okay. I know all about that. Well, anyway, we've got Steve Dills here, and he's giving a description of this grand Hanover Tavern, which is just north of Richmond, Virginia. And, Steve, since Trey just got on here with us, do you mind giving the redescription? Because Trey knows a lot about taverns. I mean, he had one built there in historic Camden, and he really knows a lot about this. So do you mind re-describing what you were talking about?
Sure, and it's nice to chat with you again, Trey. I think we hung out on the last
we
last
did.
Time I was on.
We did, and enjoyed
nice
it.
Nice to see you again. So the tavern, you know, the earliest portion of the tavern, the current tavern, or what we call the new, quote-unquote, new tavern, dates back to 1791. And that's actually considered the home portion of the tavern. The original tavern that stood there on the grounds had a license to operate dating back to 1733, and so we know that the original tavern was built sometime between 1733 and 1750s, somewhere in there. Over time, that building became pretty dilapidated. It was small. It was a one-story structure that not only served as a tavern, but also the homeowners, the folks that owned the tavern lived there as well. So they decided that they were going to build a home. So in 1791, they started building a home pretty close by. And then in 1821, they started and completed construction of the, quote-unquote, new Hanover Tavern. So it's the second tavern that's stood on that property. And then in 1831, they connected the two buildings. So for 10 years or so, these two buildings stood side by side but they weren't one building. So if you looked at the tavern today, it's pretty hard to tell, but it's actually two buildings that have been merged into one singular building.
Right.
Well, now Trey, if you don't mind, tell us a little bit about how you got that fantastic tavern area constructed, and what's the name of that house that it's in on historic Camden property?
Well, Camden, South Carolina is the oldest inland town in South Carolina. It starts on maps, just maps, not in reality, in the 1730s. But by 1758, Joseph Kershaw, county's named after, came in and established a branch office of a mercantile. Think of a Walmart expansion from Charleston. It went to Camden. And at one point, it had 17 taverns in it. All the taverns are no longer around. But there was a tavern keeper by the name of McCaw. And McCaw's tavern was a real tavern, and his son was a physician. And the building that the physician's office was in was still extant. It was moved to historic Camden, and when we decided what to do with this building, we had two choices. We could make it into a physician's office, or we could borrow the dad's occupation, which was tavern keeper. So we decided to make it a tavern because that sounded like more fun than going to a doctor's office. And so we renovated this old building and took it down to its bare bones and then built it back up. And it is now a beautiful two-room in front tavern and a small area with a cage bar in the back and a kitchen, caterer's kitchen. And so that's we use this for intermittent function. So that was a big project. When I was chairman of Historic Camden, that's one of my big projects that I did with them. And it was a lot of fun to rebuild a tavern, although it was really a physician's office, but we call it a tavern today. So,
yeah.
But I loved reading about tavern life and all the different purposes taverns serve. People just think it's a bar, but it's not. It was a meeting place. It was at a time where there weren't a lot of indoor facilities, and this was a common space that people could use for church services or circuit court riders, or certainly it could be used as a place to eat or get something to drink or to spend the night. Taverns were a very integral part of colonial America. So I'm sure you know about all of this, but that's just for people that might think, what's the big deal about a tavern? It's just a bar, but it's not. It's absolutely not.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was the center of community. I mean, it was everything. It was definitely like the life beat and, you know, almost the pulse of the community, if you will. Was where you would go and get your mail. That was where you would go, especially during times of war. You would find out there if your significant other or a family member, you know, was killed in action, wounded, missing, you know, all these sorts of things. It was quite a place. And that's what I love about them is they have this like, oh, well, you know, it's just a place to, you know, a place to go and eat and drink. No, it was a lot. It was so multifunctional and multipurpose that without them, you really didn't have a very big community.
Right.
Well, that's really cool. Well, yeah, and so you've got this wonderful structure up there. And you told me it was kind of a neat story about what happened to it in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, about a group rented that out. That was really kind of cool.
Yeah. So you know, the tavern kind of has lived its life. That iteration of its life, I should say. And during, you know, the 50s, the 1950s, a actor troupe by the name of the Barksdale Theater, they were coming down from New York, and they were looking for a place that they could set up a kind of dinner and a show, the very first, in fact, dinner and a show in America. And so they found the tavern. They wanted to try this idea out, and they did. They really were kind of the saving grace to the building, because without them, we would not have had a tavern to rally around and restore, right? When they got to the tavern, it was already pretty bad, you know, and not good shape. It had sat for quite some time. So they came down, they found this building, and they decided this is where we want to try this. This is where we want to set up. And so they did. They set up the Barksdale Theater, and it was, like I said, one of the first dinner and a show theaters in America. It was very successful, and it allowed them to use some of that money to start the restoral process, or, you know, at least keeping the building from falling down and, you know, crumbling. So they did a lot of work to bring people back in and keep it as a community center. They operated for just about 40 years. And not only were they operating as a theater, but they also lived there. So they had, you know, the theater downstairs on the first floor was a dining room, like a restaurant for patrons. And then upstairs is on the second floor is where they lived. So it was literally like you were, you know, your entire experience or your entire life was around this tavern if you were an actor or an actress there at that time period. You know, that's where you ate, slept, and drank. So, you know, it was really a really unique and really fun thing to find all this information out. And what's even cooler is there are still actors and actresses around here that recall that. And so they will come and tell us all about their time there, you know, them living at the tavern. So it's really neat to hear these stories that they have to share. And then when they had kind of, I guess, run their course for this building in 1990, they sold the building to the Hanover Tavern Foundation, which is the foundation that I am, you know, the current seating president for, and it's the nonprofit organization that owns and operates the Hanover Tavern. So basically, you know, we pretty much took over the tavern in terms of the restoration efforts. But one of the really exciting things is the Barksdale Theater still operates today in the tavern. They actually went through a couple of mergers. They're known as the the Virginia Repertory Theater. But the Virginia Repertory Theater at its core was the Barksdale Theater. So they still, you know, show 3 to 4 plays a year at the tavern, and they still operate there. But it's really neat to be able to continue that history on, even though the nonprofit owns and operates the tavern today. You know, we still are retaining that history. We're retaining that, you know, that really interesting experience that this building had lived in one of its lives.
Well, now let me ask you something. Here I go. I'm trying to schedule an event, but we are going to be holding the South Carolina Lizard Man Festival, the 5th annual, on November 11th and 12th in Sumter, South Carolina. And in honor of the Lizard Man, we are writing a play. Yes, a full-fledged play, which has some narration about the history of the Lizard Man and some little vignettes about, you know, to let the students, we're going to do this at Sumter High School. We're going to let the students act out some of the great incidences and events that are associated with the Lizard Man. Now, it's not a musical, but does the Virginia Repertory Theater ever do things that are not musicals, that are just historical and fun?
It depends. I've seen them do, you know, a number of different things. The plays that I have attended in there tend to be, you know, they have music of some sort or some capacity. but I want to say that we've had some in there that are more of a serious tone. I know that at certain times, like downtimes throughout the year, that the Barksdale Theater is not utilizing the theater. We've brought in different interpreters and like living, you know, historians kind of deal that will interpret different parts of history that played a pivotal roles at the tavern. For example, we bring in a wonderful actress by the name of Val Davis, and Val portrays Martha Ann Fields, who was an enslaved cook there at one of the plantations, like right next to the tavern. And she does this very phenomenal portrayal of Martha Ann and her plight and her escape from slavery, and you know, bringing her kids up in this very difficult world. And that's definitely not a musical. You know, that is like true to history things that we know about this woman and her family. And the trials and tribulations that they had to undergo. So they have a mix. And, you know, when we have the opportunity, which is very rare, but when we have the opportunity to utilize the theater, we try to bring in things that are, you know, history-related that can educate people but also entertain them at the same time.
Well, that's great, because what I can tell you is this play is based on two books. One is, of course, my brand new book out on Amazon, The Lizard Man Companion, and the other one is, The other one is Lyle Blackburn's book, Lizard Man, The True Story of the Bishopville Monster. We're kind of combining elements of both books to create a play, and I'm going to tell you why we're doing it, is because I want to get the monkey off my back from trying to have to film a documentary. So we're going to film the students. That's right. Students from USC Sumter are going to come over and videotape. I guess do you still call it videotaping? I don't know. They're going to film the play with Lyle Blackburn on one side and me on the other. We're going to be narrating. And so that way it's something that might be appropriate for South Carolina educational television. It's not going to be a cinematographic effort or anything, but it's going to be a lot of fun. And I'll talk to you folks, and maybe you'll want to bring Lizard Man, The True Story, up there for a night or two. It would be fun. We'll talk about it.
So Lizard Man can hit the road, John.
Buddy, Lizard Man,
I'm
taking Lizard Man to new heights, I'll tell you that. We love the Lizard
Man.
Well,
you know, you could have Lizard Man versus Godzilla, but I understand also at your tavern you've had your fair share of supernatural events too.
Yeah, we've had a lot of activity, and so that's one of the reasons that we thought that having this Paracon, this paranormal conference, would be something that we could bring the paranormal community to rally around in order to continue the preservation efforts, the restoration efforts, and also the educational and community outreach that the tavern provides on a daily basis. So, you know, we sat down and we've been doing these public investigations for years at the tavern and a bunch of different historical locations in the area, in Central Virginia and some a little bit further out. But we've been wanting to try something different for quite some time. And that was, you know, bring in some speakers and see if we can turn this into a really fun educational opportunity for folks. They can explore the tavern and hopefully find the same passion that we do about history and the importance of history in understanding the paranormal. And so that's what we did. We started, I want to say it was probably 2 years ago that we started planning for the Paracon. We got pretty close, and then we had to cancel compliments of COVID. And so it kind of sat on the shelf for a little while. And luckily, you know, we decided to go for it this past year, or actually this year, I suppose it was in January. So we decided to go for it. We felt like we could host the conference in a manner that it was safe for everybody involved. because the last thing that we wanted to do was try to host this big event and everybody come out of it sick, you know.
Well, then you could have super spreader added to the marquee of what you could do for people.
Yes.
That would have been exciting. And added just, to ghosts, maybe new
one
ghosts
of the things,
from
one
the
of the
tavern,
things we
you
offer.
Know. Courtesy of COVID, sure.
So we went for it, and it was an awesome time, man. We had a blast. We had a lot of different special guests and speakers that joined us. We had a bunch of vendors, a number of different paranormal teams that joined us. It was an amazing weekend. It was a lot
well,
of fun.
Well, I will say that you were one vendor short because of all the ice that we got down here.
Yes, it was unfortunate because it was literally like we're like planning all this, and then it's like, hey, by the way, there's going to be a big old storm that's probably going to be passing right through, and I'm like, oh, perfect. We had been watching it nonstop, whether or not we were going to move forward, if we were going to, you know, cancel, what exactly we were thinking about doing. And then, you know, a day or two before, we got the word that we weren't going to get any snow. And I don't know, you know, what was, you know, helping us, but man, we did not see any snow that day. I think we saw flurries for about, you know, 10 minutes. And the rest of the day was just bone dry. And, you know, the whole area there, we could get folks in and out safely, investigate and everything. Now, I know that, you know, where you were coming from got hammered with snow, and then just north
ice.
Of us did too.
we got hammered with ice. And so by 3 o'clock, they had actually closed Highway 17 going to Wilmington. And it was,
uh-huh.
I mean, I was very fortunate to get back to my place. You know, it was about 1:30 in the afternoon, and I was just very fortunate to get back here. I was planning on leaving about, 11:30 or 12, and it just looked too dangerous. Something said, don't do this. And then I hear, you know, Highway 17's closed, going to Wilmington. And so anyway, but I know now, don't forget to tell us, you've got, I think, two other events scheduled at the Hanover Tavern, right?
Yeah, I mean, we stay busy there. I will tell you that, we stay busy there. We just held an investigation this past Saturday night. We had folks come up and join us for an investigation. And that was a lot of fun. It's always great to just get in there and investigate. And we actually have another one that we're going to be hosting. I've got to find the date on that one. Give me 1 second. But this one's going to be a little different. One of the things that we like to do to spread kind of the fundraising to the different historical sites around us is we will partner with other historical sites in the area and host these pretty big paranormal investigations. So, for example, on March 26th, and this is not publicly announced yet, hopefully it'll be tomorrow, but March 26th, we are going to be investigating Patrick Henry's Scotchtown, which Scotchtown is a home that Patrick Henry and Sarah Shelton lived in for a number of years. It is where, you know, he was living when he argued the Parsons Clause case, one of the sparks for the American Revolution. And we're going to investigate that for a little while. And then we're going to pack up and we're going to head to the tavern and investigate the Hanover Tavern for a little while that evening. And the tavern, the Hanover Tavern, was owned and operated by the Shelton family. And Patrick Henry lived there for a period of time. The courthouse that is literally at the Hanover Tavern is the very same courthouse that Patrick Henry argued the Parsons Clause. So one of the really neat things is we can work with both of these historical locations to investigate them, but they are also tied in history together. So it makes sense. It's not like we're going, you know, from an insane asylum to a tavern and they have zero connection. These two buildings have a lot of connections over time. So it's really unique to have the opportunity to do this. And it's always a lot of fun. You know, we always get a lot of activity at both of those locations. So it's great to be able to offer that, get people out to see, you know, the historic locations in the area around us, and get to explore them in a way that they typically wouldn't on, you know, any day of the week.
Wow. When you had your January event that we missed because of the ice, did any of your paranormal investigators find anything new about the tavern that you were not aware of, or did you get any feedback from the people that you did have visit?
In terms of the activity, we've had some things recently that we haven't had in the past. We have a fairly decent grasp of the actual history of the tavern. We have a pretty good running of tavern owners and the family that lived with them. You know, like, we don't have the guest books, like check-in and all that sort of stuff, but in terms of some of your bigger figures, we know, you know, certain people that have been there and attended functions there at the tavern. Activity-wise, however, seems to be changing pretty significantly recently. During the investigation at the Paracon, one of our special guests that we had brought, which is the Ghost Finders, and just a little plug, the Ghost Finders is one of the longest indie-running paranormal TV shows in America. I was actually asked to join the cast for season 11, and hopefully further, but I filmed a couple of episodes so far with them, and so I was able to goad them into coming down and joining us, right? So Rob Thompson and Megan Deputy were able to join me, and so they are moving through with one of the groups in the tavern, and they passed by one of the other special guests that was there, Robert Bradley, and he's from a team called CPRI. Rob kind of, like, nods at Brad, and Brad just completely ignores him. And so Rob's like, whatever, and just keeps walking. Rob leaves the building and comes to what we call the coach house, which is a separate building that we use for, like event space. And so that's where we have everything set up. We've got HQ there. And so he walks in, and there's Brad standing there talking to me. And so Rob's like, how did you beat me in here? And he's like, what are you talking about? So he recounts how, you know, well, I was upstairs, and I walked past you, and I nodded and said hello, and you just, like, literally just stared like you were dead straight forward and just completely ignored me. And he's like, no, I've been here, and before that it was in the library, which is another separate building across the street. And which is really cool is I can corroborate that because I was with him. So I know that he wasn't in the tavern because he was in the library, and then he was in the coach house with me.
Yeah, that counts as scary-ass material right there.
Absolutely.
Odd. It was pretty odd because for whatever reason we've had what I will say is doppelganger-like experiences or doppelganger-esque experiences in the tavern as of late. Not necessarily sure that it would be or qualify as a doppelganger at this point, but the fact that Rob saw Brad, and the interesting thing is it wasn't just like Brad with some random clothes on. It was literally a copy and paste of Brad down to the wiring of his lapel mic because we were using walkie-talkies to communicate. Literally, like, the cord and everything, the T-shirt. He had because it was January, he had one of those long T-shirts, and then a shirt on top of it, literally carbon copy, which was really odd, right? And so that was the most recent of events that has kind of encompassed this doppelganger-style activity. A couple months before, we have actually what we call Doppelganger Dave. We've experienced this activity prior. One of the very first times that we've had this, it was Brad again, and he was in the tavern. They had left their equipment there running all night, and so they came up Sunday morning around 11 a.m., and that's when we opened on Sunday. So there's nobody in the building except maybe our chef before that time. Brad gets up to the third floor. He's breaking down DVR cabling, and he sees our executive director, David Beal, at the end of the hallway. He, you know, calls out Dave's name, tries to wave at him. Dave does not acknowledge him, and all he does is he starts walking as if he's kind of going down a different hallway. So Brad radios his other teammate, and he says, hey, I think I saw Dave, but he didn't hear me, and I'm not sure, you know, what's going on. Can you come up the back staircase and let's meet up with him and make sure he's okay? So Brad goes up the stairs, and his teammate Kenny is standing at the bottom of the stairs. The only other way that you could get down to the building is this other set of stairs on the other side of the building. So he's standing there, and he starts coming up the stairs to, you know, to meet in the middle. Lo and behold, they meet, and there is no David. Brad gives a call to Dave, and David is at home working in his yard. So,
he just vanished and ran home.
Yep, he just left. He's like, screw it, I'm going home to cut grass.
So we've got this really odd
activity that is imitating or mocking or mimicking people as of late at the tavern that we haven't seen before. And that's not even the first time that we've seen this doppelganger Dave, as we call him. We've seen him on two other occasions.
Dave was wearing, as far as clothing goes, was it the same clothing he was wearing at home?
I don't think it was the same clothes that he was wearing at home that day, but it was hard to tell for certain just because, you know, it was Sunday.
Right.
Dave had not been to the tavern at all that day.
Steve, if I could offer a little piece of I'd like to offer something here. Sounds like you have a shapeshifter. The shapeshifters are known to do that. I saw a shapeshifter once right in the apartment complex where I live. I saw a fellow walk directly through a door, and I'm on the phone with Robin McCrae of ScaryCast, and I see this guy walk up his stairs and walk directly through the door. I mean, you know, it's what I saw. And you might, I don't know, but that is very troubling. I mean, shapeshifters are the kind of things you expect at Skinwalker Ranch. And
yeah,
you might want to discuss
it's
that.
It's pretty odd.
You might want to discuss that with some of your folks and do a little bit of research, because that is a very troubling and potentially dangerous phenomenon. Been there, done that. So you might want to approach it from being, I mean, it sounds like you've got a shapeshifter. And they do exist. I mean, it's not something out of science fiction. Shapeshifters, all this stuff does exist. I mean, Bigfoot exists. Lizard Man exists. A lot of us have had experiences with them. It sounds like you guys need to make a concerted effort to figure out what to do. And, I mean, I'll ask Robin, or I've got a new friend, Jennifer. They probably know what to do. I'll see if I can get them in touch with you. Okay.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we've been doing is, you know, when we brought groups in there this past time, that's actually what we were looking for is are we going to experience this phenomena again? Interestingly enough, we didn't. We didn't experience that whatsoever. We didn't have any issues that evening. And so we are, as you know, there's two teams now that are looking at this, my team and Brad's team, trying to solve, you know, what changed, because we haven't had this experience up until maybe the last couple of months. You know, like I said, we've been investigating the tavern for almost over a decade now. And for some reason, whatever it is, something has changed, and we've got, you know, two people now that have experienced something like this. So,
or something has arrived at the tavern, or something has arrived at the tavern that you're not really prepared for. So that could be the case. So just from my experience, that's what you might want to look at. And I was going to say, do you have any more? I'm sure you've got a lot of very interesting stories. Do you mind picking out a couple of them and sharing them with us so that we can comment on them? Because this is great stuff.
Sure, yeah. One of my personal favorites, which is a personal experience versus actually recorded tangible evidence, was actually in what is called the Old Stone Jail. And the Old Stone Jail is, you know, the Hanover Tavern. The reason that there is a tavern there is because it sits within the county complex, right? So at the time, if you were going to have a courthouse, well, you needed a place to not only have court, but also to serve the people that came into town for court. So you have the tavern, but if you come on a public investigation with us, we actually also investigate the courthouse, the jail, and there's a library that is right there, too, that we have access to and to investigate. So when you investigate the tavern, you get to investigate 3 to 4 buildings, not just one, which is really, really, really neat. Every October, we host an event called Ghosts Walk at Night. And this is a ghost tour where we really partner paranormal experiences that our team and other teams have, you know, had in the tavern, but we partner them with history. And so, you know, like I'm pretty sure I said in the last time I was on the show, history is so very important to understanding the preternatural and paranormal experiences that folks are experiencing at historic locations. Like, you have to have that context to be able to understand them. It is imperative. So when we go and investigate these locations, we're using history to try to communicate. It's something that would make sense to, you know, to the idea, if you subscribe to the notion that spirits or ghosts are people that have passed on from our own reality, then they would hopefully have an understanding or context around some of the history that has occurred at that location, especially if they lived there during that time. So I'm saying all this because I'm standing in the Old Stone Jail. This building was built in 1835, and it was a fairly nasty place to be. It is not somewhere you wanted to spend a night, let alone any sentence. The Old Stone Jail is a stone building, if you couldn't guess, and it is made up of 4 rooms. There are 2 cells on the bottom floor and 1 cell upstairs with another room that housed the warden and guards. During Ghosts Walk at Night, guests that go on this ghost tour start at the tavern. They go through the entirety of the tavern. Then they come outside and they go over to the courthouse. They go into the courthouse, which is really neat. Then when they leave the courthouse, they come over to the jail. And they get to go in and explore the jail a little bit. Along the way, at each stop, instead of us just saying, you know, okay, listen, the paranormal experiences that we've had here is such and such and such and such, we actually have actors and actresses that recount these stories in the form of the ghost or spirit themselves. So it's as if we're trying to bring back to life some of these spirits through the interactions that they, you know, we've had with them, and then utilizing the history that we know about the people that have been there, the buildings, the history. So it's not made up stuff. It is actual, you know, people that had been there, events that actually occurred there, and it's a really, really unique way and a really fun way to teach people about some of the things that went on. So I'm standing in the jail, and I'm talking to one of the other teammates of mine that was hanging out with me. I'm dressed up like a prisoner, and I'm talking to him about how horrible it would have been to not only have spent time in this jail, but also to be literally firsthand audience, like literally front row audience to watching the original wooden jail that stood pretty close to the stone jail, watching it burn down. The old stone jail was built in 1835, and it was built in parallel, well, not in parallel, but it operated in parallel with a wooden jail that stood somewhere close by. I can't remember the date of this wooden jail, but the wooden jail, one evening, I want to say 5 or 6 years after the old stone jail had been in operation, the wooden jail caught fire and burnt to the ground, taking everybody inside with it. And so your first inclination is, well, I guess it's okay because it's prisoners, right? It's bad folks. Unfortunately, the wooden jail was a debtor's prison. So if you've missed your mortgage or your car payment by a day, that's where you would have been.
You're not going to be making any more mortgage.
Do what?
You're not going to be making any more mortgage payments after it went up in flames and you're in.
No, not at all. So this wooden jail, debtor's prison, right? You know, people down on their luck. The stone jail, however, was where you had your nastier of inmates. You had your murderers, your rapists, your thieves. It also was home to runaway slaves. So, you know, it was either a really sad reason that you were in there because you were trying to escape for your freedom, or it was for a really bad reason that you were in there because you were, you know, trying to do something to harm or hurt other people. Nevertheless, on this evening, these inmates literally had to sit there and watch as that wooden jail caught fire and burnt to the ground. So I was talking to him, and I said, man, it must have really been hard. It must have sucked that you were stuck here in this jail, and you couldn't do anything to help anybody else, or to help anyone for any reason. You couldn't get out to help them. You literally had to sit there, smell the smells, hear the sounds, and watch it all, and you could do nothing to assist. And I kid you not, as we are standing there on the first floor in the first jail cell, and keep in mind, the big heavy metal door to the jail was open because we were waiting for guests to arrive. And this was in between tours. There was about, you know, a 15-minute break in between each tour. We're standing there, and we hear this elderly woman say, outside, she says, I'm not stuck in there, you're stuck in there. And so I look at my teammate, and he looks at me, and we're like, what the hell? So we run outside, and of course, there's nobody out there. There's no individual, no person, no old lady, no nobody. We circle the building. I go one way, he goes the other. We find nobody. There wasn't another tour for another 10 minutes at that point, so there's no reason anybody would have been out there. There was nobody to be found. And it was so crazy because both of us were standing there, and as I'm talking about this and saying, man, it must have sucked to be stuck in here, you hear this woman saying, I'm not stuck in there, you're stuck in there. It was an experience.
Nothing like having a disembodied voice.
I'm sorry, Trey, say that again?
Nothing like having a disembodied voice chatting with you.
Oh, I know. And it was just so funny. It was so, like, matter of fact. The way that she had stated it was, like, almost in a sarcastic manner. Like, nope, I'm good. You're not, but I am.
What can you say? And speaking of that, now, and I want to make a comment. I had this weekend at the hottest spot in Myrtle Beach every Saturday and Sunday is Hudson's Flea Market. It's one of the nicest, biggest flea markets you've ever seen. And I had been working there, getting some leads for my insurance business, and I found out that I had been put right next to the Queen of Paranormal for Hudson's Flea Market. It was a real nice lady named Deborah. And so we made friends. We were right next to each other. We have permanent booths there. And she said, oh, I got something to show you. I got this thing called Necrophonics. It's a $10 app. And what it does is it does like all good ghost boxes do. You hear white noise, and then hopefully you can hear something that comes from there. Well, here's what happened. This is Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock. So she hauls this thing out. It's on her cell phone. And I was just wondering, Steve, if you guys had ever used something like this. So she gets it out. She puts it on scan. And so we're sitting there listening to white noise, and all of a sudden the thing says, John. And we looked at each other. It was my name. And then she said, is anyone with John? And the voice from that Necrophonics ghost box said, children. Like there are some children around me, some spirits of children. I thought that was bizarre. And I mean, and Steve, you said that you've heard of some of these things. I've got to get one. I haven't had time to get it and put it on my phone. But I mean, have you ever used anything like that, these kind of portable ghost boxes, these apps?
Yeah, I mean, so I always, you know, when folks ask me about the apps, I always take all of them with a grain of salt, right? To me, that they're, you know, coming from a scientific background, I always use them as experimental devices. Not to say that they can't offer and provide some really interesting insight, but I always say they're experimental. Again, that doesn't mean I don't use them. One of my favorite tools to utilize is called the Echovox. And in a very similar way, the Echovox has word banks that shuffle through the words at an interval that you can set. And it does the same thing where it provides the opportunity through white noise for words to form. I have seen the Necrophonics app being utilized before. I was actually a guest at an event here at the Beacon Theater in Hopewell, Virginia. And there was a team down that was utilizing it and had some really interesting results that contextually made sense with the history of the location that we were at. I like to use the Echovox, which I would say is fairly similar. My favorite way to do that is always with what is called the Estes method or an Estes session, depending on who you ask. But I like to use it in kind of a way that you're siloing the question, the person asking the questions from the person that's listening to the app. And so the Echovox, the same thing, it's an application. I have it installed on an iPad that I have. I am always weary of these apps maybe picking up your geographical location. So I always ensure if I'm utilizing the Echo Box, it's actually on an iPad that doesn't have a SIM card. It doesn't have any access to a cell tower. And I make sure that it's in airplane mode well before I get to any location that I'm going to, because I don't want it picking up any data that would suggest, okay, you're at, you know, whatever this pinpoint is. Okay, what are some historical pieces of information? Let's just pick random words off of a Wikipedia page that, aligns to this space. That wouldn't be difficult to do from a coding standpoint. So I always like to rule out as much as I can ahead of utilizing equipment like that, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Yeah.
So I've got some really interesting results with it. Like I said, I enjoy using the Echo Box. I don't use it kind of as the end-all, be-all. But again, in the same vein, I don't use most things as the end-all, be-all. I like to have pieces of evidence that are going to be in parallel and support each other and complement each other. So what I like to look for example, I like to deploy the EDI Plus, which is a data logger. At the same time, if I can, I'll get it as close to possible without impacting the data collection, but I use a dosimeter, which is looking for radioactive material, right? It's looking for, any microsieverts. It's counting, counts per minute of radioactive isotopes in the air. So I like to use both of these devices as well as an audio recorder, a camcorder to record all of it. And to me, one of the really exciting things is if I'm picking up something, maybe a spike in barometric pressure or a spike in counts per minute for, radioactive isotopes, and at the same time, I'm also getting an EVP. That, to me, is really wildly interesting, because it alludes more to what exactly is going on in the environment at the moment that this electronic voice phenomena is occurring, or even if it's AVP, like audible, so like a disembodied voice, or maybe it's something going on, like something being thrown across the room or something being pushed over. Maybe somebody says they're feeling like they're being touched. The same can also be applied to the metaphysical world. And we've done some really, really fun things where I've got some psychics on my team, and we'll apply the same things and look at, is there a change in EMF or barometric pressure or temperature or, whatever, what have you, as, the psychic is sitting there reading the environment or picking up on certain things. Maybe they pick up certain names or time periods or very specific attributes or characteristics. Are we seeing any changes in the environment, that will, allude to what is going on? And so that to me is, I love the adrenaline, obviously, of going into a location. But when it comes down to, like, can I look at something like the Echo Box or, the Necrophonic VAP, get something interesting, but at the same time also see a spike in some environmental data or variable that suggests there's something else going on that is anomalous to the typical behavior of this environment.
Okay, that's very interesting. Let me ask you this. Are there any articles about this type of research that I could read?
Yeah, I'll have to send you one. One of the, CPRI, the Center for Paranormal Research and Investigation, Robert Bradley is one of the research coordinators there. They're doing a lot of this research specifically around looking at this environmental data and seeing what spikes when and where and how in relation to anomalous behaviors. They've published some articles about it. I'll have to send you the link to their website, and you can check it out because it's really cool. And so we worked very closely with their team here in Virginia, and that's where, you know, we're trying to supplement their findings and their data in the same, you know, kind of the same vein, right? Utilizing the same equipment. You know, for example, my dosimeter is the GMC 320, which is the same one that they use. And that gives us a standardized way of bringing in data that can be analyzed at some of these different locations and build it out, you know, more in depth. So it's really cool work. I know other folks that I've talked to that, you know, are kind of scratching the surface on this research because I'm definitely not, you know, super in depth on it, but I love seeing this and being part of it. They've started to see the same thing, especially with the rise of the EDI plus meters, not just, you know, deploying it, but deploying it, putting in a data card and reviewing that data from the SD card, reviewing that data and looking actively at this. Other, you know, a lot of folks are deploying, you know, maybe a K2 meter or something, and okay, well, it's lit up, you know, it's lit up to red. Well, what does that mean? It's EMF, right? But what is the milligauss that it's hitting? That's very important to know, right? Because if you're saying, okay, well, there's a change in EMF, that would suggest paranormal activity, but our cell phones also will kick off a K2 meter. Our cell phones emit EMF. Our bodies emit EMF. You know, everything that has any sort of electric field or magnetic field or presence, right, will put off something. So to be able to actually look at the data other than saying, well, it was red or it spiked up to yellow or orange or whatever, but being able to actually look at the numbers and reflect back and see, is that a spike or is that just a gradual increase? And then, you know, okay, well, it moved from, you know, 0.1 to 5, but it did so by building up over the course of an hour. That doesn't necessarily say that there's something paranormal. It just says you've got something going on with your electrical.
Okay, well, that's great. Yeah, please send a copy of that, and it's all right. I might share it on Scarycast.
Sure.
Is there a way to quantitate it when you talk about looking for other environmental change in barometric pressure, the EMF? So is there a way to so you can compare what a cell phone would do versus other things? Is there a way to differentiate?
Sure, you can. There is a way, and actually, there's a certain, like, there's a certain, you know, milligauss that cell phones, walkie-talkies, all that kind of operate on when they kick off. Same thing as, like, a fridge or a microwave or a literally anything electrical. A lot of the devices, for example, the K2 is unshielded. The electric board and the cabling on the inside of the K2 of the device is unshielded, meaning any EMF will kick it off. The nice thing about your tri-field meters, your MEL meters, the EDI plus and EDI is it's shielded internally, so you don't pick up the man-made EMF. Now, that's not to say if I put my dosimeter right next to the EDI plus, it's going to kick off. But that's, you know, that's what's going to happen. But utilizing a device that is shielded, like the electric components inside are shielded, is going to help you with your data collection because you're not going to be picking up literally anything and everything.
So do you put your cell phones in a Faraday bag or something so you shield those so you know you're not picking up an extraneous signal that would be coming into your data field?
Yeah, typically what we'll do on our investigations is we will turn off our cell phones or typically leave them at headquarters, and we always have somebody there. And so, like, if – somebody calls because there's a situation that has arisen at home or an emergency or something like that, you know, they can let the folks that are out investigating know about it. And we typically will communicate via walkie-talkie. Again, if you're using things like REM pods or proximity sensors, anything that requires a EMF field, as soon as you click the walkie-talkie on, those things are going to light up.
Right.
But we try to remove as much as we can. During the right times of the year, we will, if we can, we would, turn off the heating or cooling, if it's not too hot or too cold outside, and try to do what we can to really isolate ourselves from the electrical that is, in the building. Sometimes it's not always feasible, and so we have to account for that, but that's where, you want to get your base readings when you go into a location. Let your equipment sit in there for a little while so you have something to compare to. You can't just say, okay, well, we saw this random spike, but we only investigated for an hour. Maybe that spike occurs every time that the mini fridge kicks on. You know what I mean?
Right.
Or pulls, on the panel or something like that. So those are kind of the things and the steps that we try to take to eliminate some of that contamination.
Wow, that's fairly sophisticated research, and I like that. This is definitely something I would like to learn more about. And so, Steve, looking forward to getting that link. And then what we will do is I'll share that on ScaryTech, and we'll go from there. That's great. Do you have any other stories or things you can share with us? We've got time for probably one or two more.
Sure. One of the really neat things I like, and I always hark back to it, about the paranormal is being able to tie it to history. Some of the smallest pieces of information that you get could really help you prove that something else that we can't comprehend with our current understanding of science and physics is occurring. The Hanover Tavern, for example, was one of the very first places that we implemented the idea of performing interviews before an investigation. Keep in mind, this was a very long time ago, and we were still a fairly young team. And, we would go into locations and realize, hey, we don't know anything about this place. That's not helping us at all. And so when the Hanover Tavern reached out to our team to see what we could do to help understand what was going on there, one of the first things that we did was we scheduled a day of interviews, literally one whole day. We went up there, and we invited any staff, volunteers, past staff, foundation members, guests, anybody that wanted to come up and share their stories about the Hanover Tavern. They could be paranormal. They could be just significant events that they remembered. But just anything that they wanted to share, they could. As I'm sitting there, this elderly woman walks in, and she sits down. I start my audio recorder after asking her if it's okay, and I get out my paper and pen, and I start listening to her story. And she recounts that she had lived there for a period of time during the Barksdale Theater era, right? That period of time when Barksdale Theater was performing, and not only performing plays, but also living at the tavern and operating it. And she recounted this one evening that she woke up and was quickly escorted out of the building because she was told that the Hanover Tavern had caught fire. By the time that she got out of the building, the fire had already put itself out. The firefighters arrived. There was nothing for them to do, so they left. Everybody went back inside and went back to bed. she, as she was recounting the story, she pointed to the room across the hall from us, and she said, it happened in there. And that particular room was the room we called the Washington Room. The reason we call it the Washington Room is George Washington had had visited the tavern on multiple occasions and even wrote about it twice in his diary. So, of course, we had to give a nod to George Washington. And you can tell you're in the Washington Room today because it has a huge portrait of George Washington in it. So that really stuck out to me, this whole experience that there was a fire and, you know, everybody had to be hustled out of the building, only to find out that it was already done. Like, it had put itself out. We're done. Go back to bed. I had talked to David at the time, who, you know, he was still new, you know, our friendship was new at that point. He could not recount at any point that there had been a fire at the tavern. So we're like, okay, well, that's interesting. Well, she very clearly remembers this. So was there a fire that we just don't know about? Was she just dreaming? Like, what exactly is going on? So that was something that we wanted to follow up with. So we wrap up for the day. We pack up everything. We head home, and a week later, we come out to investigate the tavern for the very first time. And we, you know, we move through the rooms. This is a very big tavern. I want to say, off the top of my head, maybe 14,000 square feet. It's a big building. And we make our way through and finally end up in the Washington Room. And so, as we're doing an EVP session in there, I ask a question along the lines of, do you know who or what started the fire here in this room? And clear as day, we hear a man reply, it was me. So, of course, we're like, okay, like, there is something going on. Like, we definitely, you know, even though there is no data that we can find that there was a fire here, now not only do we have, you know, this woman who claims to have experienced this fire as a child, but now we have something on audio, some, you know, form of spirit stating, like, oh, nope, I recall this too. I may have done this. So we start diving in deep. We're looking at everything that we can find.
Did he have anything else? Did he have anything else to say? That was it.
That was the only EVP we recorded in that room that night. So we start looking, and we can find absolutely nothing. We end up continuing on with this idea of, like, there must have been something, but we couldn't find anything. About a year or so later, the tavern brings on a new education director, and his name was Tom. And one of the first things Tom did was he went through the diaries of all of the folks that had lived at the tavern and had kept any form of diary. He read through them. I had read through some of these diaries myself, but he apparently found one that I did not. And in it was two sentences on one diary entry. That's it. Two sentences. If he was skimming the book, he would have missed it. And this diary entry said something along the lines of, you know, we were awoken by one of the dogs. The curtains in, you know, in the, they didn't call it the Washington Room, but the curtains in the Washington Room had caught fire due to an improperly installed window AC unit. By the time the firefighters arrived, the fire had put itself out, and we all went back to bed. Like, literally, if he was skimming this book, he would have missed it, and we would have never been able to complete the circle of information, right? But the fact that we were able to get this story from this woman who took the time out of her busy schedule to come and share with us her memories of the tavern, utilize that during an investigation, getting a piece of evidence that corroborates this, and then finally being able to find a piece of information, a diary, that states this did happen, here is exactly what happened, was phenomenal. It was so neat to be able to connect all of those dots.
Steve, hold on. I've got a question for you. This diary was, when did this diary date? Because air conditioners weren't around until the 40s or 50s.
This was I can't remember what year it was exactly, but Barksdale Theater wasn't there until the 1950s. So it was definitely when AC, like, window units were around.
So this is not a diary from Washington's day. This is a diary from the last century.
Oh, yes. Yeah, this was a diary that was kept somewhere between the 1950s and probably 1970s.
Oh, okay.
This is not like old, you know, history. This is, you know, somebody that had this firsthand experience that she remembers waking up to this fire. And then to be able to just, you know, even though it's not this, you know, past history of these really significant figures and things that they had done, just the fact that we were able to take something and line it up with an actual event that occurred was just awesome. I mean, it was so neat to be able to do that and to connect the dots.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's fantastic. And thank you for clarifying that. I just did not know when that diary, you know, I mean, because in general, I don't know, do that many people even still write diaries in the last century? Maybe they do, maybe they don't. I don't.
I think everybody just posted on social media today.
Was it a diary or was it like a ledger of the business?
No, it was a diary. It was one of the, I want to say it was one of the actresses. I can't remember for certain, but it was one of the actresses that had lived there for a period of time. And, you know, not only was she living there, but she was, you know, an actress, obviously, for the theater. And by proxy, everybody that was an actor and actress also helped out with the restaurant, whether it be cooking, serving, buffing, you know, being a host or hostess. So, you know, again, these folks during this time period were, like, literally living and breathing the tavern. And so they had kept this diary of the plays that they had there, some of the experiences that they had, people that had come through, you know, just little bits of information.
Wow.
Nothing super fancy, but just enough.
I guess I'd say that's some good ethnographic research and using good techniques of research like we learned at North Carolina State University, and I think you are to be commended for the type of research that you're doing. I think that's great. It really is. So three cheers to all that. You got time for one more short story, and then we'll head on to the hills here, and this episode of Scary Cast will be in the record books.
Sure. One other time, a couple years back, we brought a good friend of mine by the name of John Sable to the Hanover Tavern, and he was one of our special guests. And John, if you guys don't know John Sable, he is referred to as the Ghost Excavator. He's an archaeologist. And he has done some really phenomenal work. But one of the things that he does is also paranormal investigating. And he doesn't investigate in the same style that most folks do. He looks at the paranormal as almost an onion, and you've got to peel back the layers. And the way that you do that is by interpreting these layers. And these layers would identify to time periods. So if you wanted to, for example, to investigate the 1860s Civil War, you know, time period at the Hanover Tavern, then what you would do is you would dress in Civil War attire, whether it's civilian attire, Confederate, Union, whatever, you would dress in the attire. You would also, however, change the environment to be exactly that. So the furnishings, the objects that were there, the terms that you use, the way that you speak, the smells, the scents, music, like the lighting, everything. And so we decided it would be a really, really cool thing to try this out with John there and invite some public, you know, some of the guests if they wanted to come and experience this different way of investigating. He calls them scenarios, and he calls them scenarios because we're not reenacting historical events, but really just a day in the life. What would have normally happened? Like, not every day is magnificent. Some days you wake up, get your kids ready for school, go to work, come home, make dinner, you know, et cetera. And so we reenacted these scenes that probably would have happened on a fairly daily frequency. On one of them, we decided that circuit court was in session, and the Hanover Courthouse was a circuit court in the area. Once a month, court would come in, and you know that's the circuit. It would travel to the different courthouses in the area, and so once a month it would come back to the tavern or so.
And this was Civil War era?
This in particular, I want to say we were still in the Civil War era. I want to say we were before that. I can't remember the decade that we were kind of working scenario-wise in for this particular exercise, but this one was, I want to say it was before the Civil War, but not terribly far before it, because we were utilizing the courthouse and the Old Stone Jail, which dates back to 1835. So we didn't want to go too far back because we wanted to utilize the buildings that were already there.
All right.
So we decided that we were going to interpret or build a scenario around somebody being convicted in the courthouse, taken to the jail, and then hung, executed for their crimes, whatever they may be. This is a really neat way and a change to the way that we investigate completely. We had folks set up in the tavern, in the courthouse, and in the jail, all recording and all being present, you know, and investigating all at the same time in this scenario. As the judge convicted this individual, right? So we had somebody portraying a judge. We had, you know, folks that were going to take away this convict and drag him to the jail. As he said, you are guilty, you know, you're going to hang, et cetera, et cetera. The doors, you know, we swing the doors open to the courthouse and we start escorting this individual or one of the actors out of the courthouse to the jail. At the same time, the people in the tavern started hearing footsteps, conversations, doors opening and closing. Like, it was like somebody flipped a light switch in the tavern in terms of activity. At the same time, after we left the courthouse, because I was I was pretending to be one of the guards, right, one of the wards, and so I was dragging one of my other teammates, Zach, who was acting as the prisoner at this point in time. we exit the building, they all go dead silent, and they're hearing more footsteps, hushed murmurs, you know, as if people were, like, exiting because they wanted to witness this, you know, what was going on. We get into the jail, and we carry him up to the second floor, because that's where they would have, at that point, public executions had been outlawed, and so we were going to hang him inside of the jail because that's where it was done. We carrying him up to the steps, up to the second floor, and we have two or three other folks that were in the jail cells pretending to be prisoners but not making any noise. We're hearing whistling, like Dead Man's Walk whistling in the jail. And so we pretend to, you know, we symbolize hanging him by just draping a rope on his shoulder, and then we just have him lay down on the ground to symbolize that he had, you know, he had been hung and executed, et cetera. And we hear the whistling, we hear it. As soon as he lays down on the ground, it stops, and it is just dead silent. The tavern is dead silent. The courthouse is dead silent. It was just like something flipped the switch just for a little bit. We got this really interesting glimpse into what that sort of experience would have been like. And then it all stopped. And it was phenomenal. I mean, it was so interesting because when you're thinking about paranormal experiences, you're thinking that they tend to be localized, right? They tend to be localized to the environment that you're in, the area that you're in. If you're interacting and you know, are trying to get answers or you want somebody to knock three times back at you or anything like this. But it was really, really interesting to see that this reenactment that we had in the courthouse not only spurred activity in the courthouse, but also simultaneously in the tavern across the street and the jail next door. Three
it
different
just kind
buildings.
Of flipped the switch, everyone.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. I mean, the whole evening was amazing. We actually started out the evening by cooking foods that would have been from the Civil War time period because that's where we started our evening, was Civil War period. And so we cooked foods and served dinner as it would have been during the Civil War. Everything was candlelit, LED, mind you, because we can't have any open flames in the tavern because that building would probably light up like a tinderbox. But, you know, we had – it was all candlelit, and that's how we investigated too. We didn't allow flashlights. If you had audio recorders, they needed to be pocketed or placed an hour in advance of the scenario. And so we actually set up DVR cameras and then draped things over them so that you couldn't tell that they were there, anybody. You know, hopefully the idea was to create an experience, an environment for the guests and the spirits that it would take them and reminisce them back to a certain time period as opposed to, you know, look at all these gadgets and technology that I don't understand and I can't comprehend. But by hiding all of that and tucking it all away a little bit, we were trying to recreate an environment that would be comfortable for something, right? So we had a lot of different caveats to that evening. You couldn't come in there wearing, you know, Nike shoes. Anything with a logo you could not wear. You know, you had to wear if you didn't have anything, you know, period-esque. We were asking folks to wear, like, slacks or trousers and things like that to really fit into the time period. But I think the payoff was just phenomenal, the ability to experience that and see something so different in action was great.
What was the reaction of your archaeologist, the ghost-hunting archaeologist?
John loved it. You know, we tried to bring John back. No. he was expecting it. You know, this wouldn't be the first time that he's done this. He's actually been on a few different TV shows and showcased this style of investigating with equally as interesting results. I know that he has done it with other teams. I know that he's done this style of investigating or this technique with other teams. I know that he's worked with CPRI and Brad and tried it at some of their locations. And so, you know, when we reached out to him and he said he would love to and he would definitely want to come down to the tavern and try, we were ecstatic because I had heard, you know, all about, you know, how he builds these scenarios and like really brings it deep. And you're talking about, you know, a lot of teams will use a trigger object or a trigger song or music or whatever. The entire experience itself is a trigger. Like the just being present is a trigger in this scenario. It was really something. It was so neat to be part of and participate in. You know, I think he was you know, I want to say pleasantly surprised, but you know, it was something where he's like, you know, kind of his expectation is like, okay, if I'm doing these things and I'm building this scene that is comfortable for spirits to communicate and peel back that layer, then, you know, this will happen or this should happen. And that's, I mean, that's just one scenario. I mean, you know, they had portrayed another scenario and we watched a door close on one of the actresses that was sitting in the room by herself. I mean, it was just really, really cool. And on top of that, it was a blast. It was so much fun to do that and just try out such a different way of investigating.
Well, I think too, for a spectator, it really does put them in a different frame of mind. And it even if you didn't have any supernatural activity that you could detect, they certainly would have an enjoyable evening and the recreation of a period of time in your tavern.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, it was fun all the way around. Activity or not, it was so much fun. It's neat because it's not the style of investigating that most folks have come to see and know, especially, you know, what is shown on TV, where you break out a bunch of equipment, throw it all over the floor and see what lights up and blinks and makes noise. This
now,
is very much
equipment?
So. Go ahead.
Was any of that equipment available during that episode where you could detect electromagnetic pulses or changes in barometric pressure, the things that you've been doing in your standard investigations? Was
for
it a hybrid
particular,
or was it all just experiential?
For this particular one, the only thing that we had out were audio recorders, and we had a DVR that was kind of – the cameras were tucked in corners.
Right.
We purposely didn't set out any equipment of any kind, no data logging, nothing like that, because, you know, at his request, the idea was remove those things, you know, remove and make it comfortable because it's different. It's the unknown. Especially if you, again, subscribe to the idea that ghosts and spirits are folks that have passed on, well, they might not necessarily know in the 1850s and 1860s and whatever what a cell phone is. Or, you know, this tiny little box, you can press a button and you can look at a picture of your loved one or a video of them. You can literally watch them. You know, at that time period, it was a picture, and it wasn't a very good picture. It was a picture. So those, you know, you've got to imagine that seeing some of this equipment or something that just blinks really rapidly or makes a bunch of noise could be startling.
Might be off-putting to a spirit.
Yeah, sure. Definitely. I mean, it's the same thing as almost like a culture shock when you go from one country and you fly across the world and go somewhere else. And you know, the culture is so different that you are like – you don't know what to do and what to say. You just kind of just stop. and you just bring it all in and you don't really participate, it, you've got to imagine it's probably very similar.
Sure.
Well, so Steve, this is you have given at least me and probably Trey a different view of how to do this type of research, and we have to talk more for sure. This has been amazing. I mean, this is just another great scary cast for the record books. I want to thank Dr. Trey Donaway for being here. And thank Steve Bills, our incredible guest. I will do the quick call around to thank everybody personally, and we will reconvene next week. We've got some paranormal investigators coming on, of all things, Steve, and can't wait to talk to them and see what they're doing. So, and then, of course, we've got John LeMay coming up, and then the first week in, we'll just say next week we have got some paranormal investigators, and we will just keep going from there. So, look, thanks a lot to everybody for being here tonight, Dr. Trey, Steve Dills, and, of course, Robin McRae and Devin Tate had hall passes, and Mark Johnston was stuck in traffic and couldn't get back to his house until just about now. So, anyway, thanks a lot. We'll see you next week, the one, the only Scary Cast. Thanks, everybody. Take care.
Good night, John.
Thank you.
Good night.